Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. Today we're in lesson 181. And last time we're in chapter 29 and we finished with verse 20. We were discussing the reality of the first love, that when people love with their whole being and heart, they do not consider time or whatever they give as a great thing. It seems to be like very little. And obviously, on the other hand, conversely, when people do not love, every little bit that you have to give seems to be too much. And that's in essence oftentimes what people say, well, that's just too much, I can't take it anymore. And yet, when we love with all of our being and heart, and that is basically the nature of the first love, too much is not too much, but very little. And long time is very short time. And so forth. And that's in essence what Jesus Christ is telling his members of his body, members of the bride. He said in the beginning, when God was calling you and you came to the knowledge of the truth, giving too much was little. And whatever length of time that you spend there, listening to the apostles or the servants of God, were just like fleeting moments. But then you come to the point, as Paul would say, to the Hebrews, you get to the point where, your dulls, that is your ears, are dull of hearing. And now every little bit becomes a long time and people get tired of it. And every little bit of giving, he had to chide them many times and many other congregations, that giving to them became a burden and he had to encourage them and provoke them and so forth. You see, all those things have to be done when people lose their first love. And every single one of us can gauge ourselves at any given moment and realize at what point, at what level is our first love, by checking our attitude toward the time that we like to spend with God, either be in prayer, in fellowship, in the Spirit, and the degree to which we are willing to give, to serve, to help, with one another, and offer and contribute, or whatever it may be, do we regard it as too much? I give too much, nobody's responding, they don't say thank you and so forth. And that's in essence what God is telling his people at this end time. You see, people think we are giving too much, we are spending too much time and so forth, I want to do my own thing, and I'm sick and tired of that. This is where we are today, unfortunately. The church is not doing well in this case. Too many of us, when we check ourselves and we're honest with ourselves, we realize we're not where we should be. And so, this is the example here with Jacob. He was willing to work 7 years, and later on, as we'll come later on to that point, when he flees from Laban, his father-in-law, he tells him that that period of time, the 7 years, even though it was like just a few days for him because of his love toward his wife, Rachel, they were not easy days. They were very hard. But you see, even when you go through difficulties in life, even when it is very hard, even when it is unpleasant, or whatever it may be, when we love, then those things diminish in our sight. And when we don't love, those things become paramount in our sight. And that's how we tip the scale. And so, Jacob makes it very plain. And God, throughout the entirety of the Bible, makes it very plain that when we love Him, and that's why this is the first thing He demands from us, that we love Him with all of our being, not just a little bit, but with all of our being and heart and might and soul, whatever it may be. And when we do, then obedience is no big deal, and serving and giving and even sacrificing, and even in a few cases, and it's not generally the rule, when God wants all the way, He wants us to go all the way in terms of sacrifice, just like in essence He told Abraham, he wanted him to go all the way in improving his loyalty to God, in being willing to sacrifice his son, you see, because of his love toward God, for which cause, God called him my friend. See, your friend is willing to do everything for you. That's a true friend. And, if we're honest with ourselves, we may find out that we're not even, not only we don't have true friends, but we ourselves are not true friends. As we should be. And so, this is what God is teaching us, and this is an example here in the Torah, in the law of God, to teach the nature of God, that when God, you know, teaches us to love, it is because He Himself loved us first. And that's why it says, God so loved the world that even giving the life of His Son was not considered to Him something that it's more than He can bear to do for us. He went all the way for us, and that's what He wants us to go all the way with Him. And the only way we can do it is when we have that, you know, the nature of that first love, so to speak. And most human beings experience that first love with any particular either place, a job, a person, or whatever it may be. And then after that, you know, time goes by and we take it for granted. And then what was easy for us before because we loved now becomes difficult, and we don't want to do it anymore, and we're sick and tired of it, and so forth. So anyway, this is a good place to ponder and think about it and appreciate the problem that we all have, and ask God, even if we don't have it, to help us to return to that first love. We oftentimes cannot do it on our own. So that's something else also that God grants us. First love. And we should, you know, never let it go, but get hold of it and embrace it and flame, you know, the fire of love constantly, and throw more dry wood into it to produce the fire that will continue burning. And this is what Jacob has done here for 7 years. No matter how cold it was, how hot it was, how humid it was, whatever it may be, because his love toward Rachel was so great that he did not even consider the hardships that he went through. And so it could be with us, and so it was with us in the beginning. We were willing to give any sacrifice until we began to lose our first love. And so that's in essence what Jacob is saying here. He served 7 years in verse 20 of chapter 29 for Rachel, and there seemed unto him but a few days. Why? For the love he had toward her. And Jacob said unto Laban, give me my wife, for my days are fulfilled, that I may go in unto her. You see, in ancient times, the reality was very simple. The way marriage takes place is when a man goes to a woman and they have a sexual relationship, and it is through that that the marriage is sealed. It's not just a ceremony, as later on it became, you know, just as people put more emphasis on the ceremony itself. But the simplicity of marriage was that a man goes in unto his wife. And from that comes the term Baal, which means master, and Be'ilah, which means the intercourse. That means when a master takes hold of whatever he owns, be it a house, or a slave, or a property, or in the case of a marriage, when a man goes to a wife, he takes hold of her and she becomes his, and, you know, he takes ownership in that sense. And that's how even the terminology of a married man and the act of marriage is linked to that very word, Baal ve-Be'ilah. And so that's in essence what he's saying, you know, give me my wife so I can go into her. And Laban gathered together all men of the place and made a feast. Now this is the wedding supper. And in ancient times, as a matter of fact, an awful lot of people don't realize that the formal marriage ceremony that we have today that is performed generally in much of the world, though not everywhere, by religious men. You see, and nowadays we've got even women performing that. But that's a modern reality, basically. And when you study the institution of marriage in terms of the formality of it, how it came about, that, you know, we go either to a priest, a rabbi, a minister, whatever it may be, and then, you know, if you don't like that, in many societies they allow you just to go to the court or, you know, a judge or whatever it may be. If you are on a boat, on a ship, you know, even the captain can perform that in the name of the state. In other words, it becomes a civil marriage, not a religious. But all that is a recent phenomenon in terms of world history. And when you do some research, you find out that about 600 years ago, That's not long ago. The Catholic Church in Europe saw that an awful lot of men were abusing the marriage responsibility. In other words, you know, getting drunk and not working as they should, not taking care of their family, of the wife and children. And so with good intentions, you know, sincere intentions, there was nothing malicious there. They basically told them, that's in Europe. And that's basically the world that most of us know, you know, the Western world, you know, those who come from the Eastern world, they know their reality and how it is done there. And it's not something that necessarily the priest has to perform. It's something that you have a wedding supper and the parents are involved in it and, you know, they have different customs, sometimes just exchanging in a flower or, you know, there are many ways of doing it. Or like in Fiji, in places like that, you know, when a man and a woman rub their noses, that seals the marriage. You know, different customs, different places, but it's not a religious ceremony. But here the Catholic Church, you know, realizing that an awful lot of men were not performing their responsibility, they just told them, well, from now on, you know, so that we can be a witness to the fact that you're taking upon yourself, that is, in terms of the men, to care for this woman, You'll have to come to the doorsteps of the church, and there you're going to say before everybody that you're going to take her to yourself as a wife, and we'll be witnesses that you made that vow in essence, and therefore we'll hold you responsible for it as a community. And so they began doing it, and 200 years went by, and you know, it took 2 centuries. And the Catholic Church realized that a lot of people still were not doing what they were supposed to. So now they say, well, now you're going to enter inside the church, and there you're going to make that statement before all these witnesses, and the priest will be there. And not only that, the priest will even take part in the initiation, you know, that all that vow. And so that's how it developed into a religious ceremony. And later on, people started invoking the name of God, which they had no business doing. God never gave them that authority. You know, people just take for granted because, you know, they are raised into a world where they heard somebody saying it and they think that's the way it is and has been like that from the beginning. You know, as Christ would tell us, well, in the beginning it wasn't so. And for the majority of the history of mankind, it wasn't so. That a person had to go to a rabbi or a priest or a minister or whatever, in essence, to officiate in a ceremony in some areas, and we've been witnesses to it. Others have it in a different way. The rabbi, you know, they use different wording in the community of, let's say, Protestants. Catholics may send the same. I'm not too familiar with that. But the same, the authority that was invested in me by the court of heaven, I now pronounce you a husband and wife. You see, God nowhere ever told any priest, and you can study the Bible from the beginning until the end. Nowhere. Period. Nowhere would you ever find a marriage ceremony performed by the priest. Or the priest ever used these words. And the authority that has been invested in me by the court of heaven, you know, the civil man that perform the wedding ceremony, be it the judge or somebody else, any official, let's say by the authority invested in me by the state, I now pronounce you husband and wife. You see, all these things are man-made. And so, when a man comes to a woman and takes it upon himself to care for her, at that point, God holds him responsible. You see, and therefore, that's when the binding occurs. God is doing the binding, not men. You see, but when man takes it upon himself, he begins to think that he's the one doing the binding, and therefore he's the one that doing the loosing, you see. Now that's why, you know, when Christ told Peter about authority and how it is handled, he said, whatever is bound in heaven, it shall be bound on earth. Not whatever you bind, you know, you men. No, whatever God does. And when authority was taken by people, authority that God never gave them, then they began to think that they are the source of the authority. And they took it upon themselves. Well, anyway, just a side point here, but as you study the Bible, you know, you begin to learn an awful lot of things there in terms of how things were and how things are today. A man just went to a woman when, generally speaking, the way the custom was and still is in many areas, you go to her parents, and if they agree, and then you have a supper, a feast, and you just sit together, and whatever ceremony they come up with in terms of either putting flowers on their hands or putting a ring or whatever it may be, and whatever customs different societies come up with, all those things have nothing to do with religious ceremony. Those are just customs. But the fact that God had created from the beginning is that when a man and a woman take it upon themselves to commit themselves to each other, you see, and then they engage in the sexual intercourse, that marriage is sealed and bound by the court of heaven. And no man has to be involved in it. Only the husband and wife, by the mere fact that they have done those things, they have in essence admitted, and God binds them to that, that they now are going to be husband and wife, and therefore be responsible and be committed to each other and perform all the necessary elements that are necessary in a marriage. And then, since marriage was also an economic institution, you see, when our husband will take care of his wife and her needs and her children also, instead of the father before that, now they developed, as time went by, also a document, which in Hebrew they call ketubah, a written document. Ketubah comes from the word katu, which means written, in which he basically would say that he's going to take care for her needs, all her needs, and then the community can hold him responsible for it, and the religious community also. And so that's the way it worked. And today in most marriages, people just sign a marriage document, but there is no ketubah there, in essence, the document of the legality of the transaction, so to speak. As you find in the business community, they sign a document, and they have all the laws and the bylaws regulated by the state. And so here it was something that was between the husband and wife, and the community basically was a witness that this is what he said, and they were holding responsible for it. And also, because they trust in God and wait on God, and then they have a relationship with God, God binds them to it also, and God says, let your yeh be yeh, nay be nay. And when we utter a word from our mouth, God holds us responsible for it. And so that's the way it worked. But it's not that a man says that God gave me that authority to marry you, and I now pronounce you husband and wife. That's in essence, when you think about, the height of arrogance. People don't do it maliciously, they just do it in ignorance. And, we just take it for granted, that's the way it is. But, as Christ would say, you study the Word of God from the beginning, and you find out what was His mind, and you would realize a lot of things that we do, in the beginning, it was not so. And this is one of them. And so that's what Jacob is saying. Give me my wife, so I can go to her, and in essence, blunt words, plain words, so I can have no sex with her. In other words, that was the custom of taking possession. And in doing so, she will be my wife, and I will be her husband. And that's what he's saying to him. And Jacob said unto Laban, give me my wife, verse 21, for my days are fulfilled, that I may go in unto her. And Laban gathered all the men of the place and made a feast. And it came to pass in the evening, the first evening, that he took Leah, his daughter. The wedding ceremony generally lasted about 7 days. And the first evening, they consummated the marriage. And so this is what's happening here. It came to pass in the evening, they drink and eat and all that. And you know how people are. They drink a lot, and probably Jacob drank a little bit too much. He was happy. And it was dark, and you don't know anything what's happening in the dark. And so that's what Laban had done here, took advantage of that. So it came to pass in the evening that he took Leah, his daughter, which is deceitful, which is a lesson in essence for Jacob. And you can see how God is also using that occasion to teach Jacob a lesson. Look, you've been acting in a deceitful manner according to your very name, Jacob, supplanter. And I'm going to give you somebody else who happened to be your father-in-law who's going to teach you a lesson that it's not good to be that way. And so that's often is the case in that God, when he wants to teach us lessons, He gives us a taste of our own medicine, and we realize it's not good. And so we depart from it, and we hate it not only in others, but in ourselves. And that's a process of growth and repentance also. And so that's what Laban is doing here. He took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to him. Of course, Jacob didn't know. And he went in unto her. And once he did it, you see, he's bound, because that's the law. You see? Just like later on, as God tells Moses to tell Israel, that if a man who is not married, or maybe even married, already has one wife, if he goes to a virgin who is not married, you see, because men were ever allowed to have more than one wife, but if he takes a virgin that is not married and goes in unto her and engages in a sexual relationship with her, she becomes his wife. You see? And the only way that she would not be his wife if her father says, I don't want you to be, you know, my son-in-law. And he has the ultimate authority there. And that's the only way he can get away with it. But if the father holds him responsible for it, he has to. He already married her, but the sexual act, that's when the marriage took place. He doesn't have to go to the rabbi or the priest. But now he has to fulfill his responsibilities. In other words, God wants us to be responsible for our actions. And that's what he's saying here. And so, he went in unto her, Jacob, and now he got stuck. In verse 24, and Laban, in verse 23. And it came to pass in the evening that he took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to him, and he went in unto her, and Laban gave Zilpah, his handmaid, unto his daughter Leah for a handmaid. Well, that was a custom, especially when people were rich and could help their daughters. They will give them one of the handmaids to help her with housework, whatever it may be. So that's what he did at the same time. And it came to pass in the morning, see, all night it's dark, you don't know, you're drunk, well, maybe not drunk, but just, you know, might be a little bit too much, or just, you know, at night you don't know. And so it came to pass in the morning that, he gets up in the morning, now he takes a good look at her, and he sees her now, and it was Leah. And he said to Laban, you can imagine, you know, the commotion that happened there. What is this that you have done unto me? Did not I serve you, or serve with you for Rachel? Wherefore then have you beguiled me? And that's exactly what he had done to his brother Esau. Even though the circumstances were different, the birthright was already his, he didn't need to do it, but he did it anyway. And that was deceitfulness. Well, God is giving him a taste of his own medicine for his own good. And so Laban said, you know, Laban is not too upset by that. He said, it is not done so in our place to give the younger before the firstborn. So he's got his good reason for doing it. It's not that he wanted to be deceitful, but that was a way for him to solve his problem. And he said, well, you fulfill the week of this one, that is Rachel, and we will give you the other also for the service which you shall serve with me yet even other years. In other words, he's telling him, look, you know, the wedding ceremony, in essence, that is a feast, is 7 days. So stick around for the rest of the 7 days, otherwise, you know, you bring shame on Leah. But just continue, you know, the celebration for the 7 days, and then at the end of that, we'll give you the other person, that is Rachel, the one that really wanted. That's in essence what he did. And so Laban gave, so that's what he did. Jacob, in verse 28, and Jacob did so and fulfilled her week, that is the one of Leah, continued with the celebration of 7 days. And so he gave him at the end of that, on the eighth day in essence, he gave him Rachel, his daughter, to wife. And Laban gave to Rachel his daughter Bilhah, his handmaid, to be her handmaid, just like he did with Leah. And he went in unto her, unto Rachel. In other words, that's how he consumed the marriage, by having sexual intercourse. And he went in unto Rachel, and that's how he becomes a husband. And he loved Rachel more than Leah, and served with him yet 7 years. After, you know, in other words, a double wedding there, you know, 7 day and 7 day, one for each, and then he still had to work another 7 years for Rachel. And he did that, as difficult as it was. So now he's 14 years with Laban, working for his two daughters. And you can imagine, as he went through all that, day in and day out, he must have remembered what he himself had done to Esau, his nature, his shortcomings, and God working with him was helping him to understand and to realize that when you work with God, when you walk with God, when you serve God, that's not the way to behave. And so I began to develop the nature of God, of being honest, above board. You see, let your yea be nay be yea, nay be nay, and no need to be, you know, there is no place with God to be deceitful, to receive that which is already yours anyway. And oftentimes that's the way we act on this earth, unfortunately. People are deceitful, and in order to gain something from their brother or neighbor, whatever it may be, when in reality, if they had faith in God, if they saw God, if they understood God, if they have known God in their plan of salvation, they would have known, look, the whole universe is ours. Why do we need to deceive one another for a morsel of bread and comparison? And that's our journey in life, to learn these lessons. All is ours. See, a lot of people try to exercise dominion authority over the lives of others. And the war and people that do it are in all walks of life, be it in the business community, be it in the family, be it in the congregation, religious environment. Everybody's trying to do it. And the reason they do it is, in essence, ultimately saying, they really don't believe that God is going to give them anyway everything. And so they try to get for themselves while they're getting is good. God abhors this attitude, and unfortunately too many of us have it. And God is going to teach us lessons when we have these problems. All is ours, as Paul would say to the congregation, all is yours. Why do you say I'm of Paul, I'm of Peter, I'm of Cephas, this and that. All is yours, we're all yours. Don't need to behave that way. So, here again, there's a lesson that Jacob is being taught by God. And as we study it, hopefully we can learn that lesson without having to go the hard way in learning it. And so he went unto Rachel, and she became his wife, and he had to serve another 7 years. Complete number, perfect time. So he learned the lesson twice. And you can imagine that Jacob became a different person after that. And verse 31, and the Lord saw that Leah was hated. Now you're going to see a heavy involvement here on the part of God. Because we're not talking here, as you study this, only about an individual called Jacob, and he had a marriage, he had a wife, and all this story. It's not just a story. When you think from the point of view of God, who thinks everything through from beginning until the end, and you think about the eternity of the matter, you begin to understand, because now we have the advantage of knowing the entirety of the story, all the way to Revelation, and what is it that we find toward the end? God had chosen this family, as he told them several times in many ways. You only have I chosen of all the family of the families of the earth. Why? To be a light unto the nations. You see? Israel was chosen to be, in essence, the mother of humanity. And so, he's dealing with this family with that in mind. We don't think it that way, as we should. And in the future, what is it that you find out? Every single son that he gave to this four women of Jacob and to Jacob was going to have an eternal role. Not only in the city that Christ will reign over, the city of the great King Jerusalem, will there be 12 thrones, over which 12 apostles of Jesus Christ, and that was not a coincidence, all that was planned from beginning until the end, and they're going to rule over the 12 tribes of Israel, and each one is going to sit by the gate that belongs to that particular tribe of Israel, you see, and all the Israelites from that particular tribe will come to that gate to be taught or to have judgment from that particular apostle who will sit at the gate of that particular tribe of Israel. And so all the nations of the earth also, as the sent representatives to Jerusalem, they will enter through that whatever gates they enter. And this is where they're going to be judged, when they seek for judgment from God. Because it is from Jerusalem that God is going to judge not only Israel, but also all mankind. And so there are going to be 12 gates, and each one is going to have one of the names of the tribes of Israel. And that's not the end of the story. 1,000 years later, the Father descends with heaven in Jerusalem, which is being built. It's not complete yet, because of all the men that are going to be involved who are going to be a part of it. And so there again, you see, in heaven in Jerusalem, which is going to be forever and ever, obviously. It's not a temporary city. There are 12 gates, there are 12 foundations, after the names of the 12 apostles of Jesus Christ, all Israelites, all basically from the house of Judah, and some may be Levites and some Benjamites, we don't know exactly, but from, you know, from the kingdom of Judah. And there are going to be 12 gates, each one after the names of the tribes of Israel. So you see, when God is involved here, He's looking forward into the heaven in Jerusalem also. And that's exactly what we read in the book of faith, the chapter of faith in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, that Abraham looks forward toward this time when all of his descendants, his family, are going to be in that city whose builder and maker is God and not man. You see? Because the Jerusalem of Jesus Christ is going to be built by men. But the heaven in Jerusalem, God is the one building it. It's a spiritual one. And there, you're going to see the 12 tribes of Israel. So for those people who thought in their ignorance and confusion, and unfortunately too many of us fell for it, that God has rejected Israel, He rejected His people and chose now so-called the church, having no knowledge of what the church is all about, and forgot the entirety of the story here, well, this is one place to begin to understand what was the mind of God from the beginning until the end. As He told Jacob, I will never leave you, when He first appeared to him in Bethel, on the ladder, you know, on top of the ladder. I will never leave you nor forsake you. And He constantly repeated that statement in spite of the iniquities of Jacob. And so He said that even into the future. So this is another aspect here, that because we have the entirety of the book ahead of us, and we know it, and the story is there, therefore we can bring those things together and have a greater comprehension as we go through the book of the law. And so we see that God is involved here in verse 31. And the Lord saw that Leah was hated. You see, He's involved, He's looking, He's seeing. And He's the one, as He said later on, I'm the one that opens the womb and I'm the one that shuts it for His own purpose, as He did with Sarah earlier. For a reason known unto Him, He basically shut the womb of Sarah so she would not bear children, because He had a plan for Abraham and Sarah. But when He was ready, He is the one that opened her womb, and then she was able to conceive, and regardless of her physical condition or that of Abraham. And so this is what we see here. It is an entire plan being prepared and worked out in details by God Himself through the family that He had chosen of all the families of the earth, which He had never ever rejected, punished yet. You know, many times He did it, but He had never rejected them. And so that's what He told Jacob. Though I make a full end of all the nations of the earth, later on through the prophet Isaiah, He said, I will never make a full end of you. I will punish you, yes. I will not leave you unpunished, but I will never make a full end of you. Because He has to play a role for an eternal purpose, for eternity, to be a light to the nations and the mother of all humanity. And so when God, in verse 31, we read here, and the Lord saw Leah, she was hated, He opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. Why? Because God shut her womb, that's why. It's not just a coincidence. There was nothing wrong with Rachel, and there was nothing wrong with Jacob. There are people today, you know, to this very day, there is absolutely nothing wrong physically with them, and yet they have no children, because God, for reasons known unto Him, has shut the womb. And so Leah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Reuven. In Hebrew, Reu means see, in the plural, you know, you see, a son, Ben. For she said, because the Lord. How did she know that? You see, she was inspired. In essence, she's prophesying here. Because the Lord has looked upon my affliction. For now my husband will love me. I mean, she realized her husband, you know, was not interested in her. Was interested in the younger one. So, you know, it was painful for her. And so this is what she felt here. God saw her affliction. She was being unloved. And therefore, He gave me a son first. And so, Now my husband will love me. In verse 33, and she conceived again and bore a son and said, because the Lord, you know, she's still acknowledging him and he's in it and she knows that, has heard that I was hated. So here it is, second son, and she's not being loved yet. And Rachel obviously even hates her for that because, you know, here her sister, I was not supposed to be the wife, she has children and Rachel doesn't have any. It's not that Jacob hated her. She's speaking more about her sister here. Jacob didn't love her, but her sister hated her because of that. And so she said, because the Lord has heard that I am hated, he has therefore given me this son also. And she called his name Shimon. In other words, heard, from the word lishmoa, to hear. And she conceived again and bore a son. And you can imagine what it did to the family of Jacob there. You know, an awful lot of animosity there. And yet God is giving the blessing to whomsoever he does, and to the others he doesn't. And so as it was, you know, with Jacob and Esau. Esau was not willing to accept the fact that God was giving Jacob, even from the womb, the birthright. He was never willing to accept the will of God. And Rachel, instead of looking to God and praying to him and asking him, you know, for mercy and grace, you know, she got angry. And she had to learn a lesson herself before God would listen to her. And so, the third one, she called, verse 34, and she conceived a son, and she said, now this time will my husband be joined unto me. So she didn't use now the word of God here, of calling upon the name of God, but she realizes God is involved in every single one of that. And he wants the husband also to love her. After all, she's his wife. And according to the law, regardless of the circumstances, if she is your wife, you have to love her. God loves us. He doesn't love only the pretty among us and the good-looking among us and the intelligent among us. He loves all of us. You know, the good, the bad, and the ugly, so to speak. The fat and the skinny and the whatever it may be. That's his nature. We must develop the same. You know, a lot of us by nature, you know, we gravitate to all the good-looking people. You see, the intelligent people, all the rich people. You know, we can put up with an ugly person if he's rich. God doesn't function like that. His love is without partiality. That's a major human nature problem. You see? And so now she thinks, well, God, my husband is going to join unto me. And she called his name Levi. And Levi also has the meaning also of to borrow and also to join. Lehilavot Eli, which means to accompany me. So she, in translation here, is to join. And in essence, that became the role of Levi, to join the people to God, you see, to make the two one. And so she thought, through this son, she and her husband will become one in terms of love, not only in terms of physical oneness. And so now she has three sons. Therefore was his name called Levi, or Levi in Hebrew. And she conceived again. Now God continues to work with this woman, not with the other. He's totally involved. And every name has a meaning, because every name is going to be written for eternity on one of the gates of heavenly Jerusalem. So it's not a coincidence, all these things. It's not just a story to read. But here it is. We realize that God is preparing and knows things from the beginning before they occur. And he's orchestrating this whole thing. You know, you don't even see Jacob giving a name to any of his sons. You see the women being inspired to give the names by God directly to those are going to appear on the gates of his city for eternity. And so she conceived again and bore a son, and she said, this time I will praise the Eternal, that is Jehovah. And see, she too knew his name. As I mentioned earlier, some don't understand when God told Moses that by my name Jehovah was not known. Well, everybody knew his name. And when you understand what he really is talking about, then you begin to comprehend what he's talking about. And so she called upon the name of Jehovah, and she gave in essence Judah a name that included in essence the name of Jehovah. Yah, you see, is Jehovah, is short for God, you see, and da, in terms of praise. So Yehuda, which means to praise God, the praise of God. And so this is what she says this time, I will praise the Eternal. Therefore she called his name Judah or Yehuda, the praise of God, the praise of Yah. And she left off bearing. Why? Because God said, okay, now we stop. You don't have children anymore, because he has a plan. And when God has a plan, obviously he's going to follow through and his will be done. And so at this point, for reasons known to him, he allowed Sarah first to have the children, and then later on he was going to bless also Rachel. And obviously Rachel had an attitude, and she too needed to learn some lessons. But in either case, God was planning the family of Jacob from beginning until the end, in terms of giving the names, in terms of the sons, and how many from which. And all those things are not a coincidence, because we are talking about a very special family that God has an eternal plan for, not only for them, but through them for all mankind. So everything that we read here is a detail that has been worked out by God himself, and God is bringing about all these things to pass. And so we continue after Leah could not have children anymore, because God in essence stopped her from having children. And then we read in chapter 30 in verse 1, now when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, that's talking about four children already, that means 4 years went by, at least 4 years, Rachel envied her sister. Now, that's not the right attitude. Instead of going to God and pleading with him and humbling herself and submitting to God, she envied her sister. And through envy, we do not get what we want from God, but the opposite. And so obviously, having an attitude all this time, and we see many cases like that, that people who had pride, who had envy, who thought that they should have had something like Esau, and they did not get it from God, they were punished for it. But when people humble themselves and turn around, then obviously things are different for them. And so instead of doing the right thing, she just envied her sister. Now it wasn't her sister's fault. Why envy her? And she said unto Jacob, give me children, or else I die. And that's an attitude that obviously was not going to get her what she wanted. As a matter of fact, it got her just the opposite, because Jacob was very angry, and obviously God is very angry with us when we have this kind of an attitude. You see an awful lot of lessons there in the family of Jacob, and all of them needed to learn lessons, and apparently Rachel didn't do too well, because when she gave birth to the second son, that was the end of her life, while Leah continued to live. And so unfortunately, the beloved wife of Jacob did not have that attitude that would give her long life. And so we're in verse 2, and Jacob's anger was kindled against Rachel, and he said, am I in God's stead, who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb? He's the one that did it, he's telling her. He's the one responsible for it. And oftentimes God is responsible for those kind of things is because we are responsible for an attitude. And so he's reminding her of what is the source of her problem. It's not her sister, and it's not him who cannot give her children. There's nothing wrong with him, obviously. He just had four children. It's her attitude. And so God, because of that, withheld from her the fruit of the womb. And that's a lesson for many of us. You know, oftentimes when things are withheld from us, we should remember, you know, look at the mirror and see the real cause instead of looking elsewhere and blaming everyone for it. And so he said, God is the one that withheld the fruit of the womb from you. And she said, behold, my maid, Bilhah, go in unto her, and she may bear upon my knees, and I also may be builded up through her. In other words, just like Sarah did, I cannot have children. God withheld me from having children, you know, even though God already told her and told Abraham earlier, and they should have known that it is from both of them that he's going to raise a son. And so they go to plan B, so to speak, and the thing that that's how they're going to solve the problem. Well, as it turned out, God in essence was going to have children brought up anyway from this four mothers. God was involved in every single one of them, but on the other hand, you see, had they not got involved in that, probably all the children would have come only from them too, that is from Leah and Rachel. But so she did something that is pretty common. It was a custom. So realizing that she's not going to have a child, and on the other hand, instead of humbling herself before God and pleading with him for a child, she just goes to the second choice that she has. And so this is what she says. And Jacob does not refuse. And so she gave him Bilhah, her handmaid, to wife. You see, she's a wife. Certain laws that have changed as time went by, for example, you know, he's marrying here two sisters, Leah and Rachel. Now, he didn't plan it that way, but on the other hand, even if he did, there's no prohibition by law until Sinai. Well, anyway, we're going to stop at this point here, and this is again Mordecai Joseph saying greetings, soul of God's people, until next time.